This is The Fall Line. This week, we're bringing you part two of our discussion with Sarah Turney. She's a family member, the sister of Alyssa Turney, a true crime creator, and an advocate. And over the past few years, she's become someone who's willing to ask some of the hardest questions in the genre. What is true crime entertainment? What does it do? What should it do? What can it do? How do we build a standard and hold everyone, ourselves, creators, audiences, large media companies, accountable? How do we protect victims and survivors? Better yet, how can we support and empower them? How do we actively participate in shaping and changing the industry? So much of it is being created as we speak, in podcasts, on YouTube and TikTok, on Reddit, via social media, places where independent creators and audiences do have power. So how do we use that to make change? And what should that change look like? How do we create ethical true crime media that attracts and keeps audiences? Because that part is vital. These stories need eyes and ears on them. Traditionally, that's been achieved through lurid titles and shocking details and stories laid bare, often families feeling that they've lost control of their loved ones' stories. Many families who've appeared on The Fall Line have shared with us that they've been traumatized by media representations, but felt like they had to trade that for any chance of coverage, that it was hard for them to get. It's one reason why we always have a member of the family who participates in reviewing and fact-checking our episodes before they're published. And that issue is one of many that Sarah Turney has spoken about in the past year. Not just that families need coverage, but that they deserve the right kind of coverage, informed coverage. Another thing that Sarah and I have discussed at length and wanted to bring to you is the complexity of responsibility, ethical responsibility, in regard to the release of information. With the advent of podcasting and YouTube creators, the choice to share or not share information no longer lands in the laps of trained journalists or legal advisors. Beyond plagiarism and fair use, there are other issues at stake that can affect cases and the privacy of victims, witnesses, and families. Let me give you an example. We regularly file FOIA, Freedom of Information Act requests, here at The Fall Line. When they're fulfilled, we receive documents that have been redacted to protect the privacy of those who are mentioned in the files. Sometimes there are errors, and I receive information I shouldn't have gotten. Names or addresses or birthdays, underage people's information, ways to contact witnesses that I wouldn't otherwise have. We have a policy to discard this information, to delete it or shred it, never use it. But others can and do use similar information in similar situations. After all, technically, it was released to them. But you can see the moral quandary. I've received FOIAs that accidentally included another unrelated file tucked inside, or a report I knew shouldn't have been there because it was juvenile. In those cases, we followed the same procedure, delete or shred, but we also alerted the office who did the fulfillment, so the next time it was sent out, that information wouldn't be included. Here's the thing. There's no rule book out there for creators that teaches us how to develop our own moral compasses and decide what's right or wrong for a case. What we consider to be wrong, another creator might consider to be right. It's complex. No one creator is the arbiter, and we're all working on different kinds of cases. Someone covering wrongful conviction might have a very good reason to release information. During our discussion of ethics and true crime, Sarah and I touched on a particularly controversial situation that occurred last month in the Delphi investigation. The Delphi investigation, for those who may not be aware, involves the unsolved murders of 14-year-old Libby German and 13-year-old Abby Williams, who were killed in the Delphi Historic Trails area of Delphi, Indiana, on February 17, 2017. Their case has attracted much media attention, mostly focused on small audio and video clips of an apparent suspect that Libby managed to capture on her phone. Libby's sister, Kelsey German, has become an advocate for the girl's case. She's received some wonderful support, but has also been the recipient of some of the worst, most abusive online behavior and harassment that we've ever seen. Last month's situation involved the accidental release of court documents that relate to this case. A judge's office erroneously posted unredacted files of an interrogation to an online court system. Within hours, they'd been removed, but it was too late. Those files had been downloaded, and they'd begun to spread. The Fall Line made a reference to this during our interview with the moderators at the Unsolved Mysteries subreddit. At that time, we didn't name the case because we hoped it wouldn't spread to the media. But since then, it's become well known. The basic story is this. In 2020, Indiana authorities questioned a man named Kegan Klein, who was found to be in the possession of child abuse sex material. Media reports had drawn an alleged connection between Klein, his father Tony Klein, and a social media account known as the Anthony Schatz account, that Delphi police have expressed interest in. In the past few months, Delphi authorities have asked anyone with knowledge of this account to come forward. We have not seen these documents, so we're basing our understanding of the issue on media accounts of the document release, including People Magazine, NBC 13, and Fox 59 News. We also read through Reddit discussions on the ethical merits of the release. According to these reports, Kegan Klein was questioned about his knowledge of this account. Apparently, much of his interrogation was focused on the possession of and dissemination of child abuse sex materials. It's our understanding that this information, included in the interrogation transcriptions that were erroneously released, was unredacted. That means the names of the people involved, including children and witnesses, were included. Anyone who gained access to these documents had a choice. Should they read them? Should they share them? Release them to a larger audience? One podcast decided to do that, after redacting identifying information, like names of witnesses and minors. People feel passionately about cases. We're lucky that they do. That's why the Millbrook Twins billboard has stayed up for 4 years. It's why they have a reward fund of $11,000. It's why we have a therapy fund that now supports one family member's weekly therapy and another that's about to start. But the darker side of that passion is the feeling of ownership of cases, even when it could actually hurt that case. At one point in the next section, you'll hear Sarah specifically mention redacting the names of children. This is in reference to a podcast releasing the transcripts in an audio version. So, I think that this is actually kind of a good time to talk about social media and also parasocial relationships with cases. Because, of course, we want people to be involved with cases. And this is something more that I have observed, but you've experienced, so you can speak to it more personally. I know that for you, your ability to rally people for your sister and her case, for us, our ability to raise money for cases, that is the bright, wonderful side of this. But there are some darker sides to involving people in the lives of victims and survivors. And I think that we can talk about a few different aspects here. We talked about this briefly. We just spoke with the mods of Unresolved Mysteries, and their choice was actually to deny the posting of the recent court document release because it was done accidentally. My understanding, it was accessible to people who have access to that kind of thing, so law professionals. And once again, I could be wrong on that, but that's what I read. They were disseminated pretty widely, and then people did with them as they chose. So these would have been interviews with someone who was questioned by police pretty extensively about a lot of things. Some of them had to do with child sex abuse materials. Some of them had to do with questioning related to the Delphi case. And the document release is something that has been pretty controversial, at least in my podcasting circles, people talking about whether or not anyone should have shared those.
Yeah, of course. And it's no secret that I'm close with Kelsey German, Liberty German's sister. You know what I mean? We've become very close over the years. It's a very unfortunate club that, you know, we're all in. It's hard to see. And again, my question goes back to intentions. Are you really going to solve that case? Because obviously these are documents that the court has, that law enforcement has. They are all aware of this information. I truly have a hard time believing that people are putting this out with the best intentions of solving the case, as opposed to having exclusive, in, you know, air quotes, material to work with that will get clicks and downloads. We know what drives this market. We understand that people are going to be excited by this new information. And I think that the responsibility in large part relies on the creator of this content to say, hey, maybe this is going a little too far. You know, and I understand that an offer was made to redact the names, but to that, I'd argue that these kids know that's them. These families know that it's their children. And the fact that somebody has these documents, and just, I can't imagine the anxiety that these children and these families are dealing with, knowing that at any moment, someone could potentially release their name and that will become public. There's so many facets to this that it's a really big topic to cover. But in the end, I think that you have to be extremely responsible with that material. And it's a hard pill to swallow. But if those documents were released and then redacted, there's a reason, most likely, that they should not be out there. And I think it's really dangerous for the public to say, well, we have a right to know. But this is still a relatively fresh case that is still being worked. It's been in the public eye. The Delphi case doesn't need us to sit there and sift through these documents and try to find something there. I think it was a bad move. I think it was incredibly disrespectful. I know a lot of things behind the scenes that I can't talk about as well. But it's just something that honestly hurt my heart and makes me wonder why. And I do think the response from the public in saying, we have a right to know, is valid in a certain sense. But in another sense, you can't wait for that information. You can't wait until the proper time for when that can become public knowledge without it being redacted. Why do you need to know now? That's my question. And it's hard because it is something that I've suffered with personally. You know, when my dad got arrested, I stopped doing interviews. I stopped talking about our case. I stopped giving updates. And I literally have a video on my TikTok of me crying because somebody said, you know, we helped you do all this. We have a right to know. I care for those people. So when they said, we're upset that you're not giving us all the information, I took that to heart and I genuinely felt bad, which is why I was crying in that video because I was like, I'm sorry. It's not a fair choice for you to ask me to choose between my sister and you guys because I love you both so much and you helped me get justice for her. But at the end of the day, I can't appease you and hurt her case. You know what I mean? And I think it's a dangerous game that they're playing. And I think it's for views. I think it's for views and downloads. And I think that that's really gross. And that's my feelings on it.
It's just wild to me that someone would be willing to chance hurting a case because we don't know what effect that would have on a case. We can't know.
Right. It's not wild to me because people threaten me all the time that, oh, I'm just going to run with it. I know that you don't want your sister's case out there right now, but that's not your choice. Too bad. And it's like, I can't command anybody to do anything. All I'm asking for is human decency. All these families are asking for is human decency. And I'm sorry, those cases mean a hell of a lot more than your freaking podcast, than your YouTube channel, than your news production. I don't care what it is. These are real people with real lives, and people forget that all the time.
I did a panel with Kelsey that was for raising money for the Charlie Project. So that's been my one interaction with her. She said something on that panel that really stuck with me. She said to the panel that she was going to be doing this advocacy work for 5 years, and then she would kind of think about having a life. I don't know if people can even understand that. She's like in her very early 20s, and she's already been doing
this. She's 21 or 22, yeah.
Yeah. I don't know how many people have, starting from their teenage years, paused having any semblance of a life for themselves to completely advocate while being harassed, while being accused of colluding with murder. Someone asked, how can, you know, we support you? And she said, stop sending tips directly to me, please send them to law enforcement. Every time they open their messages, they have all these horrible things there. And it's just like that kind of stuff wears on you. and you're a kid and you're trying to go to school.
You know, a lot of people, and I don't think everyone's like this. I think there are so many wonderful consumers out there, but you know, there are people that I think it's almost like this exchange and, oh, I like you and I care about you. Now, can you tell me everything about the case? Can you take all this time out of your day to do that for me? And it's not like we're mean or Kelsey's mean and she doesn't want to. It's bandwidth. This is very hard. You know what I mean? For a lot of these people, it's just a case that they're interested in. Like, we live with this. Like, that's the point I always try to get you. Like, when you're at the Thanksgiving table and there's somebody missing, you're not thinking, you know, Liberty German should be there. It's every second of every day, and it's exhausting because we live it, and that's the difference. I don't care how much you've covered this case. I don't care how much time you've put into researching it. It's not your family. You don't own these cases. And ownership in true crime is so, so dangerous. Not only does it, you know, actually prevent other creators from wanting to cover these cases that need coverage, but it creates this sixth sense of being entitled and being owed these things, and the sixth sense of I can say whatever I want because I've done so much work on this case, and it's just wrong. And this document release in particular was put out knowing it would hurt the family. It was put out knowing that those victims would know it was them. It was put out in a harmful way, and I have to imagine they thought of that before they published it. I don't know what else to say about it other than it's harmful, and the public isn't owed anything. I think that, you know, what we wish to share is great. I am such an introvert, and I opened my soul up to this community and showed them everything I had in that case, everything I had. I interviewed everybody I could. And at the end of the day, people, you know, still think that they're owed something by me, and it just hurts. And it's not that we want to covet that information. It's that we're real people with real lives, and demanding information about our dead siblings is really hurtful.
There was an example I wanted to tell you about, which is kind of has the best case and the worst case scenario. And this is something I talked a little bit about when I was speaking to the mods of Unresolved Mysteries, because it's something I've been thinking about a lot, because I've been writing a little bit about this case for my book as well. There is an unidentified person who was known by the pseudonym of Lyle Stevick. He died in a motel room. He'd signed in under that pseudonym, Lyle Stevick. And it was in 2001, actually, September. And that led to a lot of September 11th theories. Some people thought he might have been involved in September 11th. You can kind of see how internet sleuths get involved in that. But there were a lot of people that got quite involved in his case. And there was actually a subreddit devoted to him. And people who raised money for him, you know, raised money for the testing. Eventually, his case was taken on by the DNA Doe Project. So the people in the subreddit were really interested in trying to identify him. They'd done tons of research. There was also quite a lot going on web sleuths as well. But the subreddit was super interested in his case. The DNA Doe Project was able to identify him. And when they located his family chose not to release his identity. And identities are released normally when it's an open homicide investigation, but when it's a natural death or a death by accident or someone has passed away due to suicide, that's a case where it's really up to the family. And what was really interesting to me was the Lyle Stevick subreddit really respected that. They banned any sort of mention of his actual identity. They set up this way to gather kind comments that could be delivered to the family that were like, you know, wishes of peace. And it was really beautifully done. I went and reviewed it and put up these rules of engagement for any kind of further posting on the topic. So if someone from the family was to come and look at all of this, they would see this group of people who had worked for, 17 years to try and identify their loved one and had managed to do it, because if it wasn't for this particular group, it wouldn't have happened, right?
Yeah, that's the best side of true crime, right?
Yeah, it's the best side. On the other side of things, there were people who were waiting, and they identified him. They keep connecting his photo to things against the family's wishes. I mean, Wikipedia has managed to scrub it, but they said they were owed that information because they had followed the case. When the family had made it really clear they wanted to keep it private. And to me, that's the absolute worst part of the parasocial structure, which is that to me, what's important is the case is solved. He's been identified. You don't need to know who he was. He obviously was going through quite a few things. There were many signs that he was struggling with something serious that came across just in the note that he left. All of that was made public. You know that his family was found. You know that they expressed their thankfulness for him being identified. That's what you need to know. You don't need to know who he was. You need to know that he was identified and his case was closed. But to me, that is the best and worst case of what can happen with the kind of parasocial relationships. The full respect and the lack of disrespect. You can donate to something. You can raise money for something. You can be invested. You can say you care. But to me, at least, to truly say you care about a case is to know that the case doesn't belong to you.
Exactly. And exactly. Well, and in what right does that family have to heal and move on? You know, I think they have every right. And I know that these things are different, but it almost reminds me of, like, I don't know if they do this everywhere. I have to assume that, you know, those angel trees around Christmas where you buy gifts for a child and it just says their age and kind of what they're interested in. I feel like it's almost like doing that and shopping for a few hours for these kids and being like, well, I want to meet them. I need a thank you note from this kid. Like, why are you doing this? Is it for something in return or are you doing it to help? I think that's a good question to ask, you know? Now, there was a gentleman on TikTok with 250,000 followers, so a decent following. He had made something like 100 videos on my sister. He believed that he knew where she was buried, and he asked me to go with him alone at night to a river to go look, and I said no. You know, I said, thank you so much. You know, I was very polite. Thank you so much. I think that's great. You want to look for her? I'm not coming, essentially. And that upset him. And then he started posting images of the backyard of a house that my sister never lived in. It was a house that me and my dad lived in. We moved in there after Alyssa went missing. And he said, she's buried here. That used to be a pool in the backyard. This is where Alyssa Turney was last seen. She was buried in that pool. End of story. I solved it. And I came forward and said, hey, like, you know, that's not where she went missing from. It's really important to make sure that, you know, where she actually went missing from is correct, you know, because we need people to look for her. That location is extremely vital. And he turned that on me and said, I look suspicious. And then he started making more videos about how I killed my sister when I was 12 years old, about how if he found my sister's body, I would somehow not make money anymore. All this money I was supposedly making off her case. And I mean, his followers were vicious. They were demanding photo evidence that I was where I said I was when my sister went missing at a water park. I was on a field trip. And I mean, they were demanding everything. Can you prove where you were when you were 12 years old? Can you prove, you know, as a teenager that you lived in that house? I mean, it was insane. And again, because he was fighting for this misinformation, it hurt the case. You know, there's still people that believe that she went missing from that house. There's still people that believe that I killed my sister when I was 12 years old or knew something about it. He perpetrated that idea and it just completely lost focus of the mission, and it was damaging and traumatizing. You know, it's a big reason why I took a big step back from TikTok. It really hurt me and I just couldn't deal with it anymore. So, I mean, these things can be really vicious, and somebody can get this idea in their head of, I know exactly who did this. I know exactly what happened. And it can be really harmful. And to add insult to injury, when my dad got arrested, that guy said, look, I solved it. He used it as a show of faith for his, you know, for how good he is at sleuthing. It's just, it's really gross. And when I see people with this idea in their head and they just run after it and they just justify trying to put out all this information or justify trying to get all this information, it really scares me, because you're playing a very dangerous game. On one hand, you could be right. You know what I mean? But on the other hand, you could be wrong and really damaging the family, the victims, and the person you're accusing.
I feel like people on my end of things have very little idea how vulnerable people have to make themselves.
Yeah, it didn't come natural to me. I was mortified to go on TikTok. I think I said as much in my first TikTok. I never wanted to tell my sister's story. I never wanted to be in the spotlight, but I've since become this voice, and now I feel this responsibility, so that's why I'm here. It's not because I love being in front of the camera or the microphone, because I really don't.
This is something, I think this might have been the first thing we really talked about
Yeah.
Which is the idea of what is entertainment in true crime? What people say they want versus what they seem to want, how that's reflected in our download numbers, you know, what shows get big, what shows stay small. And this is not something that we want to shame listeners about, you know, and make people feel bad about. Because one of my big things that I'm interested in, you know, just as a creator and as a writer, because that's my foremost thing that I am, is trying to make unidentified person stories narratively interesting to attract people to them. Because there are people that don't have others to speak for them. Their story's been taken away from them. So trying to create a narrative to attract people to those stories. The idea of creating a story, I mean, I don't think there's anything shameful about that. But at the same time, certainly there are some entertainment aspects of true crime that are not so great. And I think that we can both agree that there are true crime tropes that are not so great. And we are talking about, I think, harnessing the power of the kind of true crime world that you and I want to see, that some of our friends want to see, the kind of true crime that we want to make, and how we can get audiences interested and involved in that. And I think this is what you call on your show the call to action.
Yes. I mean, I think that there's a balance, right? You know, I think I truly believe that true crime has to have some type of entertainment value in order for people to listen in. I don't think that that's wrong to say. I don't think that it's a secret. If you were just simply reading bullet points about a case, nobody's going to listen. It just is what it is. And to be honest, I don't think it's quite fair to the victim or survivor or whatever topic you're discussing. I think that they deserve a well-crafted story that's told in a way that people will want to listen. I mean, you have to make it not dry and boring. And this trickles down to everything, right? Social media, your marketing, your audio quality. For me, I try to find a way to make people care and to make them take action. And I can't do that without making them feel some type of way. And that comes naturally because I feel some type of way about these cases. So I focus on the things that I feel are important. I talk about the family struggles. You know what I mean? It's hard, but I do think that there's a way to do it that's entertaining without sacrificing my personal morals and ethics. And I want to believe that I've done that pretty well.
I think for you, it's a natural and organic way to insert your personality into it because you're someone who has experienced this personally. You know, like one of our first choices was to take our personalities out of it. Because for us, that felt like the wrong thing to do. You know what I mean? Like we'll step back from the story because we're putting forth stories of people who never get to talk.
Oh, so, yeah. Well, yeah. I find myself pulling myself back all the time to be like, no, you're inserting yourself too much. You're using your personal experience too much. But of course, I have a unique angle in that I've experienced these things. So I think that I report on them in a different way. You know what I mean? And the thing is, I think people are looking for less sensational content. I think that they're just kind of unaware of the options out there. We've done true crime in the same way for so long. I mean, you look way back at, you know, public trials and, you know, the town square or whatever and public hangings and, you know, true crime has been sensational and in the forefront for a very long time, long before true crime podcasting. And I think what I accidentally did, because by no means is any of this calculated, I think what I did by posing all these questions, or at least the feedback I'm getting is, wow, I've never thought about it in that way. I've never thought about the way I consume true crime and how that might affect these stories. And, you know, on top of that, how I can also help. It's a hard balance. And one thing I found that was helpful is at the end of, you know, most of the episodes of Voices for Justice now, I do something called a secret after show. It's not edited. I talk just like this. It's totally off script. And I discuss some of those points that I just didn't think should have made it into the episode, you know, because I try to make the episode so focused on the facts and I try to not insert myself. So this after show moment is kind of like my version of like banter, if you will, that other podcasts do at the beginning. I just do it at the end so people can opt out and so that people know that it's not a formal part of the story that I'm telling. And I think people have really responded well to that. They understand that I'm trying to separate me, Sarah Turney, and how I feel about the whole world and separate it from these cases, because these cases aren't about what I feel about true crime. It's about how can I make people care and how can I make them take action?
People need that. And that sort of mix gives them options of,
these podcasts that are tackling ethical issues, and you can have a place where it's a little more relaxed. You can have a place where you have call to action. You can have a place where you have cold cases. They can see there's a variety where you don't have to listen to the one that's very serious only on cold cases. You can listen to the one that is lighter. You can listen to the one like yours, which is serious, but is focused across the board. So there's like this wide variety, right? So you can see there's just as much variety in the podcasts that are operating in what we might call the ethical space.
Well, yeah. And I mean, the thing is too, like I talk about ethics and true crime so much that you have to be mindful of not shaming people for what they like. And that's never what I try to do.
Absolutely.
Again, I always say this, it comes down to intentions. If you're listening because you like gory stuff and, you know, for bad reasons, I don't think most people are like that. I think most people listen because they like the creator and they may not understand that could be harmful and real life, because of course these creators aren't saying, well, we know this is going to hurt the family, but here's speculation and victim blaming, or we know this is going to hurt the case, but here's exclusive information from our anonymous source from Reddit or whatever. You know, they don't tell people that. They frame it in a different way. So I think the consumer is often left in the dark. But at the end of the day, I don't think most consumers have bad intentions with the true crime they consume. I think that, you know, they listen for a variety of reasons, you know, mostly being I'm curious. And, you know, I do think that there's a lot of people who want to help. You know, like I said, I think that the industry is changing. I think that this isn't going to stop. You know what I mean? Conscious consumerism isn't just true crime. People want to make sure that, you know, the eggs they buy or whatever isn't from chickens that are treated terribly. They want to make sure that the clothing they buy isn't harming children in some, you know, a terrible place somewhere. It's everywhere. And true crime cannot escape that. And it's growing.
I think you're right. And I think with each show that's produced by someone who brings something original to their show and who in some way and some capacity has thought thoughtfully. Yeah, I'm going to go with that. Who's thought thoughtfully about the subject, who is a family member or a survivor or someone who works in the industry from a expertise level, right? So a scientist, someone who is an anthropologist, someone who's a journalist, or someone who simply has been working with victims, right? Someone who's worked in advocacy. That kind of involvement, I think, has an impact on the listener. And I think that's going to lead people to remember the names of the people who are involved in the stories. That kind of research and that kind of involvement is going to perhaps lead listeners to later do some Googling. They're going to say, oh, okay, I'm going to share this story. Maybe I'm going to donate some money. Maybe I will go to that vigil. Maybe exactly. I will follow the page. Maybe I will decide not to consume this documentary that pops up because I've heard of the story and I don't get a good feeling about this, you know? And so I think that when you talk about the wave of change, maybe that's more of it, is that people just slowly become more informed. And I'm with you on not shaming people for what they listen to and what they like, because I think that all of us who make content and consume content do it for the same basic reasons, right? And it's really about just slowly learning as we do that so we can make more informed choices about what we make and what we consume.
I think that this wave of people being firsthand involved in true crime, making this content is really important to that. You know, I always say this, I've never understood why true crime is like the only facet of entertainment where it can be done by absolutely anybody. You know what I mean? I have a hard time believing that people are listening to podcast about the military from people who have never been in the military, or podcasts about the medical field, you know, from people who've never been a nurse or a doctor or whatever. I feel like true crime is really one of the only verticals of entertainment where it's like, that person's pretty, I'm going to listen to them or whatever. It's really interesting to me. And I think as more people like me or, you know, Eric and Angel come into the space and, you know, like you said, scientists and law enforcement and people with first-hand experience in true crime, I think as they enter the space more and more, things are going to continue to change because it is a totally different mindset. It's a totally different point of view.
Sarah, thank you so much for coming to talk to me about this. I have wanted to talk to you for months, and if you ever want me to come talk to you about anything, I am there.
Yeah, I'm going to have to. You have a totally different skill set than I do, and I'm going to have to utilize that for the greater good of these cases.
As long as it's not math.
Same page. Yeah, neither of us can do math. Don't count on us for that.
Thanks so much.
Of course. Thank you.
At the end here, you heard Sarah mention Eric and Angel. You're all familiar with Angel Turner by now. She's the sister of Georgia Leah Moses, and we caught you up on her recent projects, including the podcast They Called Her Georgia Lee and Angel's Faith for Justice initiative. Eric is Eric Carter Landine, the host of True Consequences. He's another family member creator in the true crime space who's become an advocate for ethics and true crime. In addition to helping other families, he focuses on the case of his baby brother, Jacob, who was murdered in 1986. Jacob's killer was never prosecuted. You can find links to their projects and to Sarah's podcasts in our show notes. We're so grateful to Sarah Turney for taking time to join us for this conversation. Families, whether they are the families of the unidentified, the missing, or the murdered, are the reason this podcast was created. We can all continue to learn from creators and advocates like Sarah. This community should continue to transform and evolve to better serve the people whose stories it is literally built upon. That is something we should all be excited to pursue. We know we are. If you know a case that should be covered on the Fall Line, there's a link to the case submission form in our show notes. Thank you for listening. The Fall Line is a fully independent show, and we appreciate listener support. It allows us to do research, obtain FOIA, pay our content advisors, and support and donate to the causes we care about. If you try out the products we advertise, please use our sponsor codes. It really helps. And if you'd like to support the show and the stories we cover, join us on Patreon. We're raising Patreon funds to continue to fund the Millbrook Twins billboard and to pay for a therapy fund for families who've been on the show. Each and every one of our Patreons helps us continue this work, and we're so grateful for your help. On Patreon, you can get early release ad-free versions of our regular episodes, plus blogs and videos at only $5 a month. We've also added video live streams, which all patrons can enjoy for just a dollar. The Fall Line is written, hosted, and researched by Laura Norton, with additional research by Brian Waters, Kim Fritz, Kiana Burgess, and Michaela Morrill. Interviews by Brooke Hargrove. Produced, engineered, and scored by Maura Curry. Line editing by Bill Bertschinger. Content advisement by Brandy C. Williams, Liv Fallon, and Vic Kennedy. And as always, our most special thanks to Angie Dodd. Currently, our monthly donation is going to Private Investigations for the Missing. Please join us in supporting this nonprofit. They need funds to help families access the services of PIs.